Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Every once in a great while, a genuine murder mystery unfolds before the public's eyes. Such is the tragic case of Susan Powell and her murdered boys, Charlie and Braden. When the pretty Utah mother went missing in December of 2009, the media was swept up in the story, with lenses and microphones trained on Susan's husband, Josh. He said he had no idea what happened to Susan and that he and the boys had been camping in the middle of a snowstorm. It was hard to know what or who to believe. Over the next 3 years, bombshell by bombshell, a world of secrets about the Powell family came to light. Josh's father, Steve, who was sexually obsessed with Susan, would ultimately be convicted of unspeakable perversion. Josh's brother, Michael, would commit suicide. And in the most stunning event of them all, Josh Powell would murder his two little boys before killing himself. Why did he do it? What really happened to Susan? This is a shocking true story of the Powell family that no reader will soon forget. The book that we're featuring this evening is If I Can't Have You, Susan Powell, Her Mysterious Disappearance, and the Murder of Her Children, with my special guest journalist and author, Rebecca Morris. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Rebecca Morris.
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for having me again. It's always nice talking to you.
It's always a pleasure, and this is one heck of a story, If I Can't Have You. Let's talk about why you came to want to write this book, how you came to be in a position to write this incredible book.
Well, and I wrote this with my co-author, Greg Olson, my sometimes co-author. We write some nonfiction, some true crime together, and he also writes a lot of fiction. But we started following this case pretty much as soon as Susan disappeared in 2009. And as you and I have talked about, Dan, a publisher is like a case that's adjudicated and has an ending. So there are a lot of cases where we just kind of watch to see what happens and saw this unfold. And I had begun in 2011. So basically a year and a half after Susan disappeared, actually, you know, putting together some research and towards doing a book. And then when Josh killed his sons and himself on February 5th of 2012, you know, we just jumped into high gear because it looked like that was, you know, the ending. Susan hadn't been found and still has not been found, but we then jumped on it and I spent the next couple of years talking to Susan's friends and family. You can't really do a book like this without extent without family involvement, and her parents, Chuck and Judy Cox, were very open with us and really wanted to keep her name and face out there, and so they spent, you know, many hours with us. I went to Utah twice to get to know her friends and to, you know, drive to the area of that desert where Josh said that he and the boys had gone camping. So then this became the first and only, you know, full-length book. One of Josh's sisters has written kind of a memoir of life in the family, but this is, it's just an incredibly sad story, and I just realized we're coming up on the anniversary. It'd be 9 years this December 6th since she disappeared.
Absolutely, and very, very close to the date in question that this horror story began, and that was December 7th, 2009. And you take us to a neighbor friend, Debbie Caldwell. And before that, you introduce West Valley City, which is a suburb of Salt Lake City, and also the subject of Salt Lake City, obviously, is, as you write, a mecca for lack of a better word, for Mormons. And so tell us a little bit about this Mormon and its connection to this story and these people, and a little bit about West Valley City outside of Salt Lake City.
Well, and that's one reason I spent a lot of time there, because I'm not Mormon, but I wanted to learn as much as I could, and I wanted to, as much as an author can, step into that world. So all of Susan's, you know, closest friends were Mormon, and her life, you know, her family, very active in the Mormon Church in Puyallup, Washington. Josh's family had been Mormon, and his father, Steve, had even gone on an assignment once, as they do when they're college age. But his father and siblings had gradually left the church, and in fact, part of their vendetta, Steve and Josh's, against Susan, you know, creating these stories that she'd just run off with another man or something. Then they turned on the church and blamed the church. But West Valley City is a suburb. It's a kind of a very sprawling, you know, a lot of malls, and I got lost a lot. I think it's really, people probably know this, but all the addresses around the Salt Lake City area pertain to their distance from the temple, and so a lot of places have actually two addresses. But her neighborhood, you know, were all her Mormon friends. They attended the same ward, which is the local place of worship in a community, and you know, it was just a very close group. They, you know, her Mormon friends were her daycare provider. They were the people she worked with at Wells Fargo. They were, you know, they walked to church together on Sundays in the neighborhood, and just a very close-knit community. And Susan was very open with these friends, so we have her, you know, Facebook posts and her journals and some of her letters, and you know, they knew that the problems between Josh and Susan were growing over the years.
Now you introduce, and again, you have mentioned that without this cooperation and this information, you wouldn't be able to write this incredible book with this access. And so that's Chuck and Judy Cox, Susan's parents. And at the time, Susan is 28 at the time of the story, and Josh is 33 years old. Then they have children, Braden and Charlie, and they're one's 5 and one's 3, or I believe that's their ages.
Well, I think they were 4 and 2 when she appeared. But their birthdays are both in February, so it's a little, you know, a little close there, but I think they were 2 and 4.
Tell us a little bit about Susan's life growing up and with Chuck, and what's Chuck's background, because Chuck's background is important to this story as well. So tell us a little bit about life with Chuck and Judy and his background.
Well, it was you know, a really close family. Chuck and Judy had 4 daughters. Susan was, I believe, the 3rd of the 4th, and the girls were close. They haven't necessarily stayed as close to the church as their parents have, but Susan and her sister Denise were particularly close all through growing up and their young adulthood. So the thing is with the Mormon Church is that the reason young couples kind of date a short time and marry is they're not supposed to have any, you know, intimacy before marriage. And so, you know, Josh and Susan dated, I think it was just 8 months before they were engaged and got married. They had met at, there are a lot of social activities for young Mormons so that they can meet each other and date and marry. And Susan had met Josh at one of these young people's events. Susan at the time was in attending a hairstyling school, and Josh was finishing at the University of Washington, I believe, and they had both, you know, dated some, but Susan assumed, you know, she and her new family, her family would be Mormons. They'd stay probably in Washington State, and you know, she'd have children. That was the most important, you know, thing for her. And you know, we know they actually moved to Utah because Josh's father was so obsessed with Susan, and she just wanted to get away from him.
Now tell us a little bit about Josh, and it's complicated, but you alluded to this, that there was problems. She believed that she was, she knew she was Mormon, but she believed that that he would come around, at least in terms of their common goal of being, of having this religious pursuit. Tell us a little bit about Josh's parents, and particularly Steve, and his attitudes towards the Mormon church and his experiences.
Yeah, and I actually forgot to talk about Chuck. I will very quickly. He is, you could not invent a more interesting character, father, than he is, you know, so sharp, so determined to find Susan and to find out the truth. And his background was he'd been in the Air Force, and he was an FAA crash investigator, so he knew about, you know, the ways investigations are conducted, and he'd been to accident sites, and so all of that would, you know, not necessarily prepare him for what happened to his daughter, but made him a particularly good ally for his missing daughter, and somebody particularly, you know, unusually sharp that the West Valley City Police Department probably wasn't used to working with. Josh's family, his parents had both been Mormons, and his mother remained Mormon. What we know is we learned a lot about Josh as a teenager from their divorce documents, and his parents divorced when Josh was a teenager. And he was one of five children, three girls and two boys. And in the divorce documents, and when his parents are you know, doing a custody battle over the five kids, it was included in the reports that Josh had threatened his mother with a knife when he was a teenager. You know, he'd killed his sister's gerbil, you know, and there had been a lot of acting out. And Steve Powell, who turned on the Mormon church, didn't just leave it, but really turned on it, had a great deal of sway over his children, four of the five children, after the divorce, lived with him, and lived with him well into their adult years, and began, you know, really believed what he believed, whatever that was, whether it was about, you know, his views on marriage or his views on the church or his, you know, views on Susan and Josh. He just was, you know, very, very controlling. And that is the atmosphere also that Josh and Susan's young sons found themselves in after she disappeared.
Now, talk about this atmosphere that she came into, and she, you know, meets Steve and the family, and is married to Josh. What are some of the events? We don't want to give everything away, because in this book, that information comes to everybody, and including the reader, in time.
Yeah.
But let's talk about what the environment was, the home environment that people, even from the outside, knew. People that didn't know everything What did people, including Chuck Cox and Judy Cox, what did they know about this relationship?
Okay. Now, are you wondering about the relationship within Steve's house or Josh and Susan later?
We're talking about Josh and Susan, but I wanted to have the audience understand that that there had been a break between Steve and Susan, and it was those events.
Susan and Josh lived for a while at Steve's, and you know they had some various jobs, and they were having trouble sort of standing financially on their own. And Steve invited them to live in his house for a little while. They actually lived in, I think it was a second bedroom or a den on the main floor that didn't have a door, so they hung curtains. But Susan discovered that Stephen was a voyeur and was, peeking at her and brushing up against her. And he even declared his love for her, and we know we found out later that he was also taking pictures of her when she was in the bathroom, and she didn't know it. But he had this idea that Susan would leave Josh and Steve would marry her, and they'd raise his grandkids together. So she told Josh that, this is pretty creepy, and he agreed they could move, so they moved to Utah. So she, really fled Puyallup. Her parents, Chuck and Judy, I don't think they knew the details of what was going on. Susan, pretty much all along the way protected them in some ways. They weren't people that she turned to when things were at their worst with Josh, and she had friends that she turned to. But I think there was a lot her parents didn't know, because, of course, one of the important things in the Mormon faith is that you stay married and you do whatever you have to do to stay married. And Susan did go to counseling with a Mormon counselor, and Josh, I think, went once, and that was it. But she most likely was encouraged to work things out. So what her friends knew at the time of her disappearance was that Josh wasn't working, Susan was. Josh controlled the money. Josh sometimes didn't give Susan enough money to buy groceries for the kids. Susan sometimes called a neighbor to see if, if they had a couple extra hot dogs or something she could feed her boys.
Wow.
Josh had turned, he was always kind of quirky, but the people around Susan, began to pick up on he was just, becoming mean and controlling, and they were very worried about her.
It's interesting, too, that you talk about not having enough food, and she was the breadwinner, but also that at the same time he was depriving her of things and the children of food. He didn't deprive himself of anything, did he?
Oh, my gosh. His garage, when he packed up after Susan went missing, within a week or two he was packing up to leave, and he had two, three, four of everything in the house, whether computers, cameras, gardening equipment. He just had just boxes and boxes of things and duplicate things that he'd bought. So he, treated himself to whatever. The more I found out about this story, Dan, the more it became, it's a story of domestic violence. They were not known to the West Valley City Police before she disappeared. It wasn't that Josh, beat her and had been called to the house, and the police had been called to the house numerous times. There's a lot of domestic violence that doesn't fall into that. What we think of domestic violence, it's very controlling, and they did shove each other you know, once somewhere along the way. But, you know, I discovered that Josh had actually been planning for a couple of years to, you know, he didn't want to be married. He didn't want to be a father either, but which was surprising because he, you know, fought tooth and nail for custody of the kids later. But he didn't really want to be a father. He didn't really want to be a husband.
Let's talk about the children before we talk about December 7th, 2009 and the crime scene itself. That's very, very mysterious and has more questions than answers.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the 4-year-old and 2-year-old Charlie and Braden, and just a little when those children arrived and how happy was Susan, and also some talk of a little bit later that not everybody, especially Chuck and Judy, by that time thought it was unusual for her to have another child. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, Susan was just elated when she found out that she was pregnant with Charlie was the first son. And one of the strangest stories in the book,
yes,
Dan, is just the story of the day that she was to give birth. And her parents had come down from Puyallup to West Valley City to be with her. And, you know, her water broke at home. And Josh was downstairs on his computer and couldn't kind of be bothered to step up. Her parents drove her to the hospital.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And while she was in labor, you know, Josh finally showed up. And he had his laptop with him and was sitting across the room on his laptop. And, you know, her parents are holding her hand. And finally, Chuck goes over and sort of, you know, grabs his arm and says, "You've got to come, you know, speak to Susan." And it's just one of the strangest things I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
And she wanted more children. And Braden came along a couple of years later, and she was hoping for more. There's a slight chance that she'd been pregnant and had miscarried just before she disappeared. Her friends thought that perhaps that had happened, but she hadn't really shared that news with anybody. And once people knew the kind of father that Josh was, you know, people had doubts about her doing this by herself, but she did want more children.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about December 7th, 2009. It's a fresh snow outside of Salt Lake City. There's a storm, you write, that there's a 3-day winter storm.
Yeah.
And Debbie Caldwell is her daycare provider and her friend and her neighbor. Mm-hmm. So what happens that morning?
Well, the morning of December 7th, 2009, which was a Monday, Josh or Susan didn't show up at Debbie's house with the boys. And Debbie was a licensed child care provider and, you know, one of their closest friends. And so she had 6 or 8 other children, and she piled them in her van and drove to Susan and Josh's house. She was, you know, Susan was extremely responsible. Susan would have called and checked in or let Debbie know if their plans had changed. And when she couldn't reach them on either of their cell phones, she drove to their house. And there had been snow overnight, and she could tell from being outside the house that no car had been, you know, been down the driveway or up the driveway, and there were no footsteps in and out of the house. She still couldn't reach somebody. She called Josh's oldest sister, Jennifer, who came to the house, and then they called the police, and Jennifer gave them permission to break a window and go into the house. And there was just no sign of the family. In fact, Susan's purse was on the bedside table, and you know, we know now that there was some blood spatter in the living room. So they finally, hours later, reached Josh on his cell phone. And, you know, and he says, you know, he took the boys the night before camping and where they'd gone. And basically, Jennifer and the police say, you know, come to the house right now. Come right now. And he spends a couple more hours, you know, putting the car through a car wash and dawdling around. And meanwhile, the police have discovered that Susan hasn't been seen since Sunday afternoon when she went to church with the boys, you know, came back to the house. Her friend Giovanna came over to help Susan with some knitting or crocheting. And Josh, who never lifted a hand, you know, volunteered to make dinner and had made pancakes and took 2 or 3 hours making pancakes. And in the meantime, he'd called his father and had a long conversation on the phone also. So Susan hasn't been seen. Susan didn't go to work. And the police look through the van window of Josh's van once he finally pulls up at the house, and they can see that there's a second phone in the car, and it's Susan's phone.
Right. Now, with this, all these friends that are concerned, you talk about Giovanna, you talk about Debbie Caldwell, and of course it's their own family as well.
Mm-hmm.
You just talked about this fresh snow. Police are eventually called. What happens? How does this proceed? What do people think has happened? And regardless of what they think, how do they act, especially towards Josh?
Yes. Well, right away, I mean, I can't think of a family member or friend of Susan's that didn't think to themselves, what have you done, Josh? And a couple of them expressed that to Josh, what have you done? And, of course, he just said, you know, she didn't want to go camping with them. And this really ridiculous story that he confused the days, he thought that they were going camping on a Saturday night and they'd come home Sunday. Well, you know, no, they came home on Monday, and he hadn't called out. He was working by then, and he hadn't called his job to say he wasn't going to be there. So people immediately think that Josh is somehow responsible. But what they do is they just play nice because they think there's more chance that they'll find out what happened to Susan if they're not accusatory. Josh is taken to the police station that evening, so Monday evening, and he's interviewed, you know, by the police, and then they let him go home, and they let him go home in his van, and he spends all of Monday night cleaning his van. The neighbors can see him, you know, going back and forth to the van and the garage, and he cleans up the house, and he cleans the garage. The car. And then he's supposed to go back to the police department the next day. And he stalls and stalls and stalls. And finally he is called Susan's father. So this is now, she's been missing, you know, more than 48 hours. And that's his first, you know, contact with her father. Chuck encourages him, Josh, you're supposed to be at the police department. You've missed your appointment. So finally, Josh goes down to the police department, and they take his car to keep it and go through it. And he walks out of the police department and gets a ride to the Salt Lake City airport and then goes missing for 2 days. So, which is, and his sons are with his sister. So, I mean, you know, clearly something is going on, and the police haven't really been. They don't watch him. They don't follow him. They don't seize his car immediately. And they kind of got off, the whole investigation got off on the wrong foot.
How do Chuck and Judy proceed here, being the grandparents and worrying and being concerned about these grandkids, and also obviously their daughter? How do they proceed? And we talked about him being an investigator at mm-hmm. heart. So what does he do?
Yeah.
And especially you just mentioned that the police probably aren't responding as fast as Chuck would like. What does he do?
Yeah. Well, within a few days, I believe by the next weekend, he's come to West Valley City, and there is a, you know, gathering at the family's ward, and you know, not a memorial service. Nobody knows that where Susan is or that she's deceased, but there's kind of a gathering. But the first thing Chuck did, which I think was really fascinating, is that he called Ed Smart, the father of Elizabeth Smart, who had been, you know, kidnapped out of her home and, you know, tortured and assaulted for several months before she was found. And, of course, and the Smarts are Mormon, and Chuck called him and said, "What do I do?" And Ed Smart said, "You do whatever you have to do to keep Susan's face and name in front of the media." So Chuck and Judy, you know, within a few days, they had a news conference in Puyallup with the media to talk about Susan, and a very emotional news conference. And then he, you know, went to West Valley City to talk to the police and to talk to Josh, and they didn't really have a long sit-down talk. He saw Josh at this kind of service at the ward for Susan, but that was about it. There were some candlelight vigils that Josh went to and took the boys to, and there were also vigils in Puyallup. But Josh did not, you know, like we see a lot of spouses, both sincerely and insincerely, speaking to the media when their spouse is missing. Josh, you know, didn't do that. He was caught by television reporters a time or two, and mumbled something. But he didn't, you know, he didn't get out there and you know, put a face on this and plea, you know, for help from the public. He retreated to his father's house.
Right. Now, you write about all of the people that are friends, people that are involved in the church, but also people that work with her. And it's interesting that she's always, and the family knows this, Chuck and Judy, know that she's always journaled since she was a kid. But there's also a diary or journal that was found by a coworker, and the coworker knew about it. Tell us a little bit about this journal or diary and its contents.
Well, she left a couple of things. One is her coworker found at, I believe, in her desk at Wells Fargo, a letter that said, "If something happens to me, look at Josh." And then it also directed them to a safe deposit box where Susan had handwritten out a will and, you know, mentioned her children and also mentioned if something had happened to her, you know, look at Josh. The other thing Susan made was just a couple of months before she disappeared, she made a video recording of herself walking through the house and talking about their belongings and Josh's, you know, the things he'd spent money on. And I think that was really for two purposes. One was if they divorced and separated, she wanted an accounting of, you know, what they owned. But the other thought that must have been in her mind, because she says on the video that if something happens to me or, you know, if I'm gone missing, you know, she wanted this video of what, you know, what was where was what was where in the house and what was going on in the house. And so it's quite but she, you know, for a number of years she had given herself deadlines to pursue a divorce, and usually every April, leading up to every April when their wedding anniversary was, she'd say, okay, maybe, you know, this April, this spring, I'll talk about divorce. And she did talk about divorce to Josh, and he basically threatened her and said he would take the children, and she'd never see the children again, and was as intimidating as he possibly could be.
The police as well discover, at least it looks like to everyone, that she had this plan, that she had had enough, and she documented her frustration in this marriage, but as a Mormon, she wanted to honor that marriage and stay with him. However, she had her limits. Tell us a little bit about some of the things she says regarding that and that deadline and his behavior that's intolerable to her.
Well, there was a lot of psychological controlling going on, and as I mentioned, she was very open with her friends, and I know that they have wondered, you know, in recent years if they could have done more, if there was any way they could have intervened, but, you know, there was a certain acceptance with time of, oh, that's just Josh. Josh will be Josh. And, you know, no one could have known what he was planning. The money and not having enough money even for diapers for the boys. And, you know, none of us can explain why Susan tolerated that when she was the one, working full-time. She did talk to an attorney at some point in the last few months of her life, a divorce attorney, and on his suggestion, I think that's when she wrote her will, and she also opened a bank account that Josh didn't know about. But, you know, some of the telltale signs that we kind of take for granted after somebody disappears is that, you know, Josh and Susan were buying large amounts of life insurance. Susan knew Josh was buying this, but it was for the children. And but it was just a bad situation, and Susan was doing what she thought was best, you know, for the boys. Not that Josh was a great father, but they loved him, and it would have been a void without him. But there was this threat that he'd, you know, take the kids that was hanging over her.
Mm-hmm. You introduced the character Giovanna, and Giovanna is unique in that she really didn't know Josh. She hadn't met Josh until 13 days before Susan's disappearance.
Yeah.
So she has this unique perspective on who he is at least this time. And there is talk in your book that there's a Utah Josh and a Washington Josh, and that once he had moved to Utah, his character had completely changed for some reason. And she's and you talk about that around Thanksgiving, Giovanna would see Susan, Josh, and the boys more than six times. However, with that, nothing she could pinpoint, but she said that something was off, but couldn't say what.
Yes. Yeah, so she was, somebody pretty new in their life, and I can't remember if Giovanna was new to the neighborhood and they hadn't, and they were just getting acquainted, but they found some things in common. She and Susan both sang in the choir at the ward, and they, there's one night a week when the women in the ward meet and do crafts and talk and worship, and so she was getting to know Giovanna in that way. And Giovanna was also able to babysit a little bit for Charlie and Braden. So when Josh sort of left Susan without a backup, she could call Giovanna, and Giovanna's children are mostly grown by that time. So it was rather unique, because where Susan's closest friend, Kiersey Helliwell, who lived down the street, you know, had known Josh, you know, for years, Giovanna was seeing this, you know, very late stage Josh who couldn't seem, you know, just seemed so nice and so helpful and making, you know, inviting her to stay for dinner that Sunday and making the pancakes when he didn't know how to make pancakes. But he, you know, called his father to get a recipe. I mean, who needs a recipe, you know, to make pancakes?
Sure.
And
wow.
She just thought, you know, he was, you know, a pretty good husband. But she also saw his, you know, his quirks. And then Giovanna, you know, she was the last person to see Susan. So this new friend becomes, you know, the very last person to see Josh and Susan. And, it's kind of mind boggling, really.
What we see Josh do too, and you write in this book, is very interesting, that he talks to, Kersey and her husband, and he has all his laptops at this point. The police have proceeded with this and have confiscated his laptops and cell phones, and there's been searches on his van. And so he goes to these friends that are still, they may be suspicious, but they're still acting like his friends and supportive, and he sets
yes.
up a website in dedication to Susan. In reality,
yep.
tell us what that website really looked like and the tone of that
right.
website.
Well, the website began, and Josh was never shy about asking people or demanding people to help him. So, but you're right, Kersey and her husband John went along with it because they were trying to, you know, be on Josh's best side. So the website initially was, you know, pictures of Susan and the boys and just kind of, you know, remembering her. And it very quickly became something else, and I think as soon as Josh made it back to Puyallup at his father's house, they turned that site into a website that attacked Susan, attacked the Mormon Church, blamed Susan. There was a man in Utah who went missing at about this just a few days before Susan did, who's never been found. They jumped on that and decided that the two of them had run away together. You know, Susan had deserted her boys. So the site became very much Josh and Steve against Susan and the world, blaming the Coxes, blaming the Mormon Church, and it just, you know, was you know, her friends were just terribly sad to see that this is what was happening. Also, about that time, Steve let it be known that he had Susan's teenage journals had been left in his house in storage when Josh and Susan had moved to Utah, and that became something that he thought he could leverage, you know, and kind of blackmail Susan's family with.
Mm-hmm. We have forgotten to talk about the children, and the two children that were maybe likely witnessed something, had information,
yeah.
but they're very young, and they are interviewed by police very, very, very carefully.
Yeah. In fact, the first night that Josh is interviewed at the police station, they have the boys go along and, you know, the police buy them a soda and everything like that. The next day when Josh is down at the police station and they confiscate his van, the children are with Josh's sister Jennifer, and they are taken to a very specific agency that the police department works with, where there's a social worker, to talk to the boys. And even though they're 2 and 4 years old, they have information. And one of the boys says that Mommy did go on the trip with them. Mommy was in the back of the van, and Mommy stayed with the crystals that she was left where they'd been looking at rocks or something. And so they surprise Josh at that second interview with, you know, here's what your sons are saying. And they still, you know, let him walk out of the police station, and that's when he goes off and rents a car. So the kids, you know, it's such a young age, but they were very clear with those couple of memories that mommy was in the car, they left mommy. And later we'd find out just how impressionable, you know, Josh and Steve were on them, because between the time their mother disappeared and they went to live with their grandparents, and Josh had visitation, they were emotionally and physically damaged. It was just, you know, the saddest thing about this.
Absolutely. We're going to talk more about Chuck and Judy and the having the custody of the children and their behavior after all of this. But we're going to stop for a second to talk about Meissen. Meissen makes high-end kitchen knives that are comparable to $150 knives, but sell them directly to you for a fraction of the price. Everyone has a knife in their kitchen. Most people have a dull one that doesn't work well anymore. You may think if you're not a great cook or don't cook enough, you don't deserve or need a high-end knife. But everyone needs it, and now with Meissen, everyone can afford one. Just like any other job, having the right tools can make all the difference, and cooking is no different. A solid high-end knife is essential for any home chef. The problem until now, that your only options were cheap and low quality or something expensive. Until now. By selling directly to you, the consumer, Meissen is able to cut out the middleman and save you money. Free sharpening for life. Even the sharpest knives eventually dull. Meissen knows how aggravating this can be, so they offer free sharpening for life. Just send the knife back when it dulls, and they'll ship it back good as new. I've tried the Meissen chef knife and the paring knife, and I have no idea how I ever cooked without it. Cooking is faster, easier, and actually more fun. And now you can also join in the fun in your kitchen. My listeners will receive a free paring knife when you purchase their chef's knife simply by going to Meissen.co/murder. That's a $35 for free. That's Meissen, Meissen.co/murder, and start cooking sharp. Now, we talked about, and you alluded to, Chuck and Judy, thankfully, gaining custody of Braden and Charlie, and while Josh remained having visitation.
Yeah.
Right from the very beginning, there was some odd behavior exhibited by the children. Tell us a little bit about what Chuck and Judy saw.
Well, and they never actually got custody. What they did is the boys lived with them, and they were officially foster parents when Josh, when they had to move out of Steve's house. So the boys spent, let's see, two years living, or a year and a half living with Josh and Steve. And I'll just include a quick step here in this whole story. So Steve had Susan's journals from teenage years and was threatening to publish them. That let the police, gave them reason to go into his house. And they raided Steve's house, and guess what? They found that he was a voyeur and had pornography and had been taking pictures of neighbor girls on the toilet through one window. And so the boys were removed from Steve's house, and after a few days they were given to the Coxes just as, you know, temporary, basically. And well, Josh had to, you know, start this ugly custody battle. And what the boys told, you know, their grandparents is that, and they had been, you know, they'd been indoctrinated by Steve and Josh, that the Mormons killed their mother, that it was the Mormons' fault, that they hated Mormons, they wanted to kill Mormons, and also that their father slept with them naked, and they were naked, slept with Josh. And then there was an incident in a bathtub. The boys are taking a bath together, and Chuck hears something and goes in, and the younger boy, Braden, is holding Charlie's head under the water, and Chuck told me it just, they weren't playing. They weren't playing. Something had had just this terrible, you know, terrible effect on them. And so it must have been extremely disorienting for them. And they, you know, went to school, and under the guidelines of the, you know, Josh trying for custody, he was allowed visitation. There was a minister that, who was a neighbor of Steve's, that kind of befriended Josh, and one of his weekly visits could happen at this minister's house. And then Josh, apparently without the knowledge of the local police in the Puyallup area, rented an empty house and, you know, put a couple things in it. And that once a week one of the visitations would happen there. And the caseworker, who was always, you know, with them on visits, I think I was for a long time the only interview that she'd ever given. The other families who would have visitation down at the, you know, the office building in Pierce County where people saw their children, they didn't want to be around Josh. And so somehow it was approved that the boys could go to this empty house. And then, you know, then February 5th happened, and Josh shut the door in her face, and just this terrible thing happened. So the boys were, you know, definitely acting out at their grandparents' because, you know, they'd spent their mother was gone, you know, for 3 years, and they'd spent a year and a half, 2 years with their father and grandfather.
What was revealed in the search of Steve Powell's property in regards to his obsession with Susan? What does he claim in there? It's incredibly disturbing, but tell us what he says and believes and has written.
Well, he you know, I read all, I think it's 10,000 pages of his journal. You know, this man couldn't shut up, and he just was obsessed, you know, with himself, very, very narcissistic. So he really thought that Susan loved him and returned his feelings for him, and of course she couldn't stand to be around him. I will say one of the most interesting things that that I found in his journals is that a year or two before Susan went missing, Josh had been visiting his father, and Steve wrote that Josh was fantasizing about Susan's death and fantasizing, mm-hmm. you know, somebody comes to the door and says she'd been killed in a car accident or something, and that Josh really wanted out. And that's just horrible. But what they found when they went into Steve's house was they found these photographs he'd taken of the little girls next door, and they found other pornography and child pornography. And so within a couple of days, Steve was arrested and charged with pornography and voyeurism. And then he, you know, eventually did serve two different prison terms.
Let's talk about this. You've talked about the search of the vehicle, of the van, but there is another vehicle that police don't know about, and another trip. So let's talk about the trip that that Josh went on that initially police were not aware of, but also the idea about Mike's car eventually being searched by police and their interest in that.
And this wasn't known to us. I can't tell you how many times I rewrote this book, Dan, because, I mean, it was just, there were new things becoming unknown.
Certainly.
All the time. And so they didn't know where Josh was for those couple of days when they seized his van. And incidentally, they found all kinds of weird things in the van, you know, shovel and garbage bags. And then they found that that Thanksgiving weekend, so just a week before Susan disappeared, he'd been, you know, at some big box stores buying a welding, you know, welding equipment and all kinds of odd things. But what happened is when Josh went to the Salt Lake City airport and rented a car, and I believe he got a temporary, you know, throwaway cell phone. And what we found out about a year and a half, 2 years later, is that he called his brother Michael, who was in Puyallup, and he and Michael met up. And I don't know that we'll ever know for sure where Josh had put Susan's body. He said that he and the boys went camping out in an area that was southwest of Salt Lake City. There was really no verifiable sighting of where they'd gone. The idea was that, well, there are 10,000 abandoned mines in Utah, and that he might have put her down a mine. But somewhere, she was somewhere temporarily for a couple of days, because he and Michael met up, and the Susan's body was put into Michael's car, and then they took it somewhere. So there's an 800-mile stretch of road between Salt Lake City and Puyallup, Washington. And, again, the police only found out later that Josh had rented this car and disappeared. And they found out later that Michael's car, he basically had abandoned at an Oregon car lot, a junk car lot. And a couple of years after Susan went missing, there were dogs, bloodhounds, that did alert on Michael's car. They didn't necessarily have Susan's DNA in the car, but there had been, you know, human remains in his car. So they, you know, seized the car, wrapped it in bubble wrap, and you know, took it back to Utah. And that's when they began later to then put pressure on Michael, on Josh's brother. So, you know, it's just kind of mind-boggling that the police weren't watching Josh or following him. I don't know. I can't necessarily point to other cases where that did happen, but you know, he was never named a suspect. He was named a person of interest eventually. But you know, the other thing that this has gotten me very interested in is literally what are called no body cases, that they can't bring charges for. I mean, it's very, very rare to bring criminal charges mm-hmm. before a body is found. And when people, you know, still on Facebook or social media say, you know, why didn't they just arrest Josh? Well, they didn't have anything to arrest him for. Mm-hmm. They didn't think so.
And you talk about the anguish that Chuck Cox has as a father and also an investigator and also someone trying to help the police. And he is getting, I mean, they're treating him well in terms of they can't give him information that would indicate what would indicate their investigation completely, but they are giving him some hopeful idea that maybe there'll be some kind of arrest.
In fact, too much, because he was when they had when the boys were living with them. So this is in 2011 and the very beginning of 2012. Chuck says the police told him every week, you know, there's going to be an arrest. An arrest is imminent, you know, any day now. And literally they were told that over and over again. And I don't know what the police were thinking. The man who was the police chief then has since retired and talked a very little bit about the case, but of course couldn't at the time. I think the Coxes were misled, perhaps just so the police department would buy time. I know that as recently as a few months ago, the Coxes were still trying to get a copy of the police report that is not redacted. I mean, it's nine years, and everybody's dead. And I think this is a frustration that authors and that families and a lot of people face is, why can't they know what else the police department found? Well, one reason might be that the Utah police found something, you know, pretty interesting on Josh's computer that they never shared with the police in Washington State. So part of this confusing case is that we now have two states involved. And they didn't share this news with Washington State. And if they had, the boys wouldn't have been living with Josh.
And what is that information?
Well, that information is that Josh had what's called toon porn on his computer. And they knew that from just a couple of days after Susan went missing. All of it was very incestuously themed. It was incestuous stories. And I had to look up toon porn. I'd never heard of it. And it takes, somebody's made these animated films that take well-known characters, like the characters from The Simpsons and other cartoon characters, and put them in incestuous stories. And West Valley City, you know, never let on about that for a couple of years. And I think if they had, the boys wouldn't have been living with Josh, and maybe he wouldn't have been allowed, you know, these private visitations in this rental house. You know, I mean, one of the things that's come out of this story is that, you know, why should family reunification always be the goal? Sometimes it's not the right goal for the children. Shouldn't the safety of the children come first? And why, you know, family custody visitations should be in a building that with security and with, you know, people around and not some rental house.
Right. You also talk about that there was
a lot better.
You also talk about that there's some striking things that happen with other people interacting with these children. And there is a talk about that camping trip and something about mummy in a trunk. Tell us a little bit about that, incredibly.
Well, I don't think there was another vehicle. Mommy was in the van with them, in Josh's van. Were you saying there was a separate vehicle?
There was these children saying certain things, and yet they were not. I mean, I know it's sensitive to be able to interview these children, but they were not interviewed by police, even at the urging of Chuck. Chuck would be, as you write in the book, there's many times when he would call police with new information. He was told, just hang in there.
But there
was a very specific warning that he had for police. What was that warning, and what was that fear he had about Josh?
Well, Chuck, he always thought Josh was going to do something. He always thought Josh was going to kill them. And he did warn the police. Of course, they kept up this, an arrest is imminent. So the children were interviewed. I don't know that they were, they were interviewed when Josh was, you know, the second interview he had with the police, when they were the social worker. But also they were, they had pretty extensive physical exams when they came into the foster care system in Washington State. I don't know that they were ever interviewed again about, they were, you know, one of the boys drew the car, the van, and with the four of them in the van. And so whenever something like that would come about, you know, Chuck would let the police department know. And also one of the boys drew a drawing of what was him and himself, and the words, "Don't play with me" or something, and a big X over the picture, as if he was, you know, trying to tell an adult to stop messing with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Chuck warned them continually, you know, Josh's going to do something. And
you talk about this incredible investigation that police are doing, and then Chuck and Judy and even members of Josh's family are, everyone, including Susan's friends and even friends of Josh, have now turned against him and believe he is guilty, that
mm-hmm.
everything that he did, all his actions, there's a list of things that people find incredibly disturbing and only draw suspicion to him. You also write about instances where Chuck and Judy would see the children and Josh would not allow these children to see their grandparents.
With
this investigation,
that's a few months when he's gone back to Puyallup with them, mm-hmm. and they, you know, they should have been, you know, permitted to see their kids, and he would occasionally, Chuck and Judy would show up where they knew, you know, somebody would alert them that, you know, Josh is at Home Depot, Josh is at Costco, and so Chuck and Judy would go and hoping to see the boys, and they might, you know, catch a glimpse of them. But he, of course, wanted to control the situation, and it wasn't until, you know, the house was raided and the boys were taken that that they were able to spend much time with the boys.
You talk about the investigation and the December camping trip. Police are very curious about going back to that area and conducting a search. You have mentioned that the idea that there was some talk of the thousands of mines that potentially could have been where she could have been hidden, and there was some talk that Josh had said something along those lines. There was a witness to say something like that. What was the result of that search by police?
Well, it's actually a little sketchy to put together how much they searched and where they searched. They did, the police were very controlling of the investigation and of the searches. You know, there were times where media were allowed to kind of go along and film. And they did have, they did search some mines. They also at least once fabricated a search to sort of, you know, keep the media kind of in their hip pocket. I mean, literally there was a search where they never intended to be searching, but they just went out for a day and let the media know they were going out. So that doesn't give them much credibility. At one site, they found some items that had been burned, and at one fire pit, you know, this is out in the middle of nowhere, a dog alerted on something, but I'm not aware that anything ever came from those searches, that they ever found anything or even something that was burned. I know that to this day, anytime remains are found in Utah or, you know, Eastern Washington or Nevada, that, you know, people wonder, you know, if it's going to be Susan, and it hasn't been to date. But, you know, the searches were very inconclusive. And, you know, they really can't decide. Well, once they knew he'd driven the 800 miles, you know, they stopped looking out on the desert, and they did some searches. They knew that the day that Josh met up with Michael and moved the body, Josh drove 400 miles in one direction and 400 miles back to the airport. So it gives them a little area there. Now, Chuck has sort of taken up, you know, the responsibility and the mantle for the searches, and every once in a while he and some volunteers, you know, go and look at an area. But it's hard to say what, you know, where they put her.
Let's fast forward, as you do, to 2012 and the child custody hearing, and something very, very interesting. A psychosexual evaluation is called for, or he'll lose his custody. And so
and
tell us a little bit about this exam and the conditions under which he is forced to do this, and tell us a little bit more about this hearing.
Well, this is you know, the tipping point for Josh and for the whole story, in that sometime in January of 2012, the information about the pornography on Josh's computer is shared with the Washington State court system. And Josh and the Coxes are in this custody battle. And so when the psychiatrist who is charged with examining Josh and doing an evaluation as far as Josh getting custody back, as soon as he learns about this, that changes the nature of what he will be talking to Josh about. And the court orders that, because of that, that Josh undergo this psychosexual exam. And what it means is that he would examined, you know, be shown photographs to see, you know, what prompts a reaction from Josh, and this would, you know, be about sex and incest sex. But the other thing that really tipped Josh is that he would have to undergo a polygraph for the very first time. It was mandated, and that means he could be asked about Susan. So at about that point, late January, Josh knew the handwriting was on the wall. He was going to never get custody of the boys. Now, I don't think anybody can explain why that was so important to him, since he wasn't a very good father and didn't really, you know, want to be a father, but it was to win was what was important to him. And to get back at the Coxes, I mean, he really hated them at this point. And he wanted to hurt them. And so he began thinking about, you know, some other way out when he found out he would have to take this exam and take a polygraph.
Now, you introduce the character Griffin Hall. Tell us who Griffin Hall is and their connection to this sad end chapter.
Oh, well, this is Elizabeth Griffin Hall, who is the caseworker assigned to be at custody visits with Josh and with the Coxes. Anytime the boys, you know, went back and forth, she would drive them, and she also had to be in their presence at all times. She's an incredible woman. You know, she was really highly educated, had a PhD. She had the most, you know, the difficult, really difficult child custody cases, you know, very sensitive ones. She really cared about the boys. They got to know her. They got to trust her. You know, they'd talk about various, you know, just lots of different things, because she spent, you know, quite a bit of time with them. And it was that day on February 5th that she pulled up to the rental house, and the boys ran ahead of her, and Josh was at the front door, the door open, and the boys ran inside, and as kids do, and she was coming up behind them, and he just grinned at her and shut and locked the door. And she, you know, knocked. She tried to get Josh's attention. She right away called both her agency, and then as soon as she could smell gasoline, and she backed her car out of the driveway, and she called 911, and you can read the excruciating interview.
Yes.
When she's trying to get the attention of 911 and get them to that house and trying to explain, you know, who Josh is and what's going on. And then the house exploded. And I don't think she's ever gone back to work. It was just a terrible, terrible experience for her. And we know that Josh, you know, hit the boys on the head with a hatchet before he blew up the house. I don't know whether he was trying to kill them first or just subduing them before but he had, you know, thrown gasoline all over the house, and it went up pretty quickly. And he had spent the last few days, so the days between the hearing, when he found out about the sexual exam, he'd gone to the bank, he'd closed his accounts, he'd talked to his attorney about something. He had told his sister about, you know, what bills needed to be paid, but waiting until that Sunday morning to basically say goodbye in a couple of texts.
Absolutely. Now, of course, everyone, this is a devastating end to this.
Mm-hmm.
What did the police find after all of this? And as we talked about it, what does, to this day, what is Chuck Cox? What is his mission?
Well, the police, Josh had a storage area, and they went through it, and basically they just, you know, found some things at Susan's and the couple's. They found that he did have this trail of he'd been to the bank. You know, you can see him on the camera. He'd bought a couple of, you know, gas tanks and filled them with gasoline, and had done some, you know, preparation like that. Chuck right away, well, the police chief from West Valley City came down the next day and sat in a car with Chuck, and Chuck told me that the police chief cried and said, you were right. You were right. We just shouldn't have, you know, let him stay out there. And so Chuck, there have been a couple of lawsuits, and so and then of course a year after Josh killed the boys, the police were looking at Michael because they'd found his car, and
right.
Then, as you mentioned earlier, Michael, who was in graduate school in Minnesota, jumped off a building and killed himself. So, you know, just this whole family, you know, everybody was just gone. Chuck, there have been a couple of lawsuits. One was that Josh's mother and two sisters and brother wanted, you know, part of the life insurance that Josh and Susan carried. And so that was, you know, involved in court action, and they finally settled and kind of split things. But there's also a lawsuit. Chuck and Judy have sued a DSHS in Washington State that that the children were not protected in the way they should have been when they were in foster care, and that's been denied once, and then they're appealing that, and I think that's still in the appeal process. As far as I know, everybody's still trying to crack Josh's, one of Josh's computers was so encrypted that the FBI couldn't break through it. And so they're wondering, you know, what, I don't know if it's a different computer than the Toon Porn was on, but they're still working on that. And then everybody thought, you know, Steve Powell was the last person alive to who might know where Susan was.
Right.
And he served a prison term for the voyeurism of the photos of the little girls, and then also went to trial finally for pornography and served a prison term. He was paroled in 2017, and this July had a heart attack and died. And, you know,
wow.
I've never really bought the argument that he knew what his sons had done to Susan and where she was.
Really?
And because he had such a big mouth. He was just such a loose cannon. I don't think they confided in him. That's just my little theory of having spent years, you know, on this case. I don't think they would have confided in him because he couldn't stop talking or writing in his journals. He might have learned eventually what happened, but I don't think he died, you know, with this secret. And but they've had time to go through his whatever, you know, journals he might have kept the last year of his life, and I haven't heard that anything was found at all.
So despite maybe people thinking just bad apple and bad father in the first place, regardless of that, they seem to have completely different motivations regarding Susan. And with that, they've concluded that they probably didn't work in tandem with each other to kill her. Is that
well,
what you
initially,
think?
Initially, Steve was, you know, everybody considered him a suspect because
mm-hmm.
he'd been obsessed with Susan. But the police were able to confirm he was in Puyallup that weekend when Susan mm-hmm. went missing. So he may not have been, you know, instrumental in it. We know Josh talked to him on the phone that day for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and we haven't talked about that. They did find some evidence in the house. There was some blood spatter. And when the police
sure.
first climbed through that window and went into the house, there was a wet place on the living room rug with a fan pointed at it, you know, going a
yeah.
mile a minute and drying something. But there was blood spatter on some tile, and still none of that was enough to make an arrest.
Yeah, incredible. And you could see the frustration of Chuck and Judy along the way, too, that there was no arrest, there wasn't an arrest, and he is trying as hard as he can to provide as much information to them, knowing what likely
yeah.
what an investigator needs to be able to make
yeah.
these kinds of arrests, and that incredible frustration throughout this for the children's
well,
sake, for his daughter's sake, and for the case.
Who knows about investigations and
yeah.
whose experience is, as a lot of families' experience is, that, you know, they're going to be the last to know, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, families are often the last to know when something is found or some information is found or what's going on with the investigation. And I can understand why, you know, they talk about the integrity of the investigation. And but when you have a parents like Chuck and Judy who, you know, they weren't about to go sharing it with people about what
sure.
had been found, I think it was just incredibly frustrating for them. And then to get, you know, then the only police report they've ever seen is redacted. You know, another thing that was thought about in Washington State, this did not become law, but one of the thoughts that started to go through the legislature is, you know, maybe a parent who is even an unspecific suspect, just in general a suspect, not even called a suspect, but let's say a parent whose spouse is missing, maybe they shouldn't have custody of their children. So that
yeah.
was one of the laws that was looked at. But I think the idea that and we've seen this in other cases, that the somebody suffers when the goal is family reunification. Often,
yeah.
It's the children who suffer. I mean, maybe that's not always the goal.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard to work on a story like this and not come up with, your own opinion. And I like to write a book that the reader is going to make up their mind. They're smart. They're going to put two and two together and figure out what was going on here. It was just such an incredible tragedy. And I will say also quickly, I like stories working on books, Dan, that are more about than just the crime. The crime is the end of the story. I wanted to know who these people were, and I wanted to know, who Josh was. And I found friends of Josh's who'd cared about him, before he went over to the dark side, or whatever you want to call it. And, we got criticism because there's a family portrait on the cover of If I Can't Have You, and Josh, with his arm around the boys and Susan. People said, well, why should Josh be on the cover? Well, he was a member of this family, and the book is about the family. And I really tried to find out, who was Josh, and, why had people, liked him early on? And what happened to this family and this community that a crime like this would happen? And that also took me back then to Steve Powell's history, as his childhood, that there was a long, long history of dysfunction in Steve and Josh's family. This just didn't come out of nowhere.
Absolutely. And really, we touched on a few things, but there is also included in this interviews with Dr. Phil, with the family, some really profound information was said at those interviews. And also, October 16, 2010, on Susan's 29th birthday, 150 of her favorite colored balloons were released.
Oh.
150 purple balloons.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's incredible.
She's still remembered, yeah. And she always will be. I mean, this is, it on one level, it remains, a mystery. What happened? What happened to her? People would like to know. And then the why, I think, we'll look at for a long, long time. What is there to be learned? I think there was a lot to be learned from a case like this and from, two different police departments that really didn't communicate very well.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you very much, Rebecca, for coming on and talking about If I Can't Have You, Susan Powell, her mysterious disappearance, and the murder of her children. I want to thank you very much. For those that might want to take a look at other of your true crime books and other of your work,
sure.
Do you have a website, Facebook page? Tell us about that.
Yes, very much. The website is RebeccaTMorris.com, and I'm on Facebook. And incidentally, there are a couple of television documentaries about the Susan Powell case coming up in the next few weeks that...
Right.
One of them I was involved with, and so I do a lot on Investigation Discovery Channel about cases, and so people can always check out what's going on Investigation Discovery too.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you very much. I'm not paid to plug them, but. But,
yeah, well, it's just another, I think a lot of people will take this, they will read the book, they'll also look for all kinds of, I know this,
yeah.
People will look for all kinds of other supplementary information,
yes.
Because they just can't get enough of this incredible story,
yeah.
And you've really spurned their interest in this incredible case. And if I
well,
can't
I,
have
I
you,
think it's
Susan.
A really, I'm really proud of the book, of the 8 books I've done. I think it's just, pretty up to date, except for Steve Powell dying suddenly a couple of months ago, but it's very solid, and it was 3 years of research and interviews and going to the places and talking to everybody and driving out into the desert all by myself to see what's it like out there. You have to go too. you have to go to these places to be able to write about them.
Absolutely. Well, I'm so sure glad that you did, and you did the incredible work that you have. Thank you very much,
Dan,
for a great interview. I hope to speak to you again soon. Good night.
Thank you. Me too. Bye.